I want you to take a second and just picture the street you grew up on. Like, really put yourself there right now. When you close your eyes and look at it, what do you actually see? I mean, is it a perfect architectural blueprint in your mind?
Probably not.
Right. Like,
Yeah.
are the property lines flawlessly drawn, the streetlights spaced exactly 30 feet apart, every single brick sharply in focus? Or is it more of a sensory experience?
Yeah, usually it's sensory.
Maybe it's the distinct smell of wet asphalt right
Right.
after a sudden summer storm. Or, you know, that really highly specific hazy orange light that only happens at like 7 p.m. in July.
Well, we almost never archive our lives in hard data and perfect geometry, do we?
No, definitely not.
Right. Human memory is notoriously terrible at storing mathematical dimensions. Instead, we archive our lives in atmospheric conditions and emotional resonances.
Yeah.
We remember the temperature of a place, you know, the mood of it, long after the exact architectural layout has just totally faded into the background.
And that fundamental difference between the rigid physical reality of a place and the soft emotional memory of it that is the beating heart of our deep dive today.
It really is.
We are unpacking a rather brilliant watercolor painting called Sevilla, created by the Colombian artist Jero Duque.
It's such a compelling piece of art because, honestly, it acts as a catalyst for a much larger conversation.
Oh, for sure.
We're really looking at the underlying purpose of painting a landscape in the modern era, especially when, you know, we all have high-definition cameras in our pockets.
Right. Why even paint it? And we've got a fantastic stack of sources for this one to help figure that out.
Oh, definitely.
We're primarily looking at an audio debate that meticulously breaks down the painting's specific watercolor techniques. And we're pairing that with the artist's own self-critique.
Which is pretty rare to get.
It is. Plus, there's this really fascinating exploration of how memory and art intersect. So our mission today is to figure out how a painter's deeply personal memories and the heavy emotional weight of creative exile actually dictate the chemistry and physics of what happens on the canvas.
It's fascinating.
We're asking a big question here. Does a lack of rigid traditional structure hurt a painting, or is it like the secret ingredient that makes it work?
And we find this amazing tension in our source material regarding that exact question. I mean, there are two very distinct opposing viewpoints on Sevilla.
Right.
One camp argues that the fluid, blurry, almost foggy watercolor technique perfectly captures the biological reality of how emotional memory functions.
But the other camp.
The opposing camp argues that by abandoning technical spatial structure, well, the artist just flattens the image. They say it weakens its impact and leaves the viewer completely lost in a visual fog.
Okay, let's unpack this by looking at the geography and the timeline of how this painting came to be. Because the physical context of the artist really changes how we view every brushstroke.
It changes everything, yeah.
This piece was created relatively recently,
Well.
In October 2022, but it wasn't painted in Colombia.
No, not at all.
Jero Duque painted this in his studio in Whittier, California, which is thousands of miles away from the actual location depicted on the canvas.
And that physical displacement is the key to the entire work. He's relying on a web reference image just to get the basic skeletal layout of the street.
Right, just for the bones.
Exactly. But the true source material isn't a digital photograph. I mean, it's his own childhood and youth. He is painting Sevilla, a vibrant town in Colombia located right in the heart of the country's coffee cultural landscape.
He's painting the nocturnal vibe of what's known as Calle Real, the Royal Street.
Right.
He's trying to capture the feeling of the 1970s, the music of that specific era, the Friday night flirting, the friendships, and this constant heavy evening rain that completely defines the region.
So it's very atmospheric.
Very. He is purposely not trying to paint a glossy tourist postcard here.
And because of that, we have to view this artwork as a negotiation of exile.
A negotiation of exile. I like that.
Yeah, because he is physically displaced in California and temporally displaced from the 1970s. That vast distance, both in miles and in decades, that becomes the invisible framework of the painting.
Wow.
The act of painting becomes a way to, you know, bridge a gap that can't actually be crossed in real life.
I have to push back on this a little bit, though.
Yeah.
I think a skeptical listener might look at this scenario and ask a very blunt question.
Okay, let's hear it.
If he is sitting in a comfortable studio in California, just looking at a computer screen to remember what a street looks like, isn't painting a blurry atmospheric scene just an easy way out.
I see what you mean.
Like, isn't it just a really convenient excuse to avoid drafting complex architecture, difficult vanishing points, and mathematically accurate shadows?
Well, it's a highly common critique leveled at impressionistic or atmospheric art, for sure. But we really have to look at the cognitive science of how memory actually works. The physical and temporal distance you mentioned is exactly why the memory of Sevilla transforms into such a fluid visual experience. Memory simplifies and abstracts by evolutionary design.
Because it's trying to save space, basically.
Exactly. The brain discards unnecessary structural data to save cognitive load. It holds on to the emotional valence instead.
Oh, that makes total sense.
Right. So when Jared Duque thinks back to Collier Real in the 70s, his brain doesn't retrieve the perfect, razor-sharp contrast of a shadow cast under a parked car. It retrieves the sensation of the humid air on his skin.
So to paint it with razor-sharp architectural precision would actually be a false document.
Exactly.
It would be an inaccurate representation of the memory itself, even if it was technically structurally accurate to the physical street.
That is the paradox at the heart of atmospheric painting. If you're trying to document a memory, and memory is inherently soft at the edges due to how our neural pathways degrade over time, then applying rigid architectural drafting techniques to it, well, it creates a lie.
A beautifully drafted lie. But a lie nonetheless.
Exactly. The blurriness isn't a lack of technical skill. It's actually a highly accurate translation of the psychological state of nostalgia.
That transition from cognitive psychology to the actual physical making of the art is wild, because we aren't just talking about abstract emotional concepts here.
No, we're really not.
We're talking about literal chemistry and physics. The emotional state of nostalgia is translated into material physics through his choice of supplies.
And the material choices are where this gets incredibly specific. Our sources note that Sevilla is painted on Arch's 300-gram cold-pressed paper.
Okay.
And he's using Daniel Smith brand watercolor paints. Now, to a non-painter, that just sounds like a standard shopping list.
Right, just brand names.
But those materials are performing a vital narrative function. Let's break down the mechanics of the paper first.
Okay, so it's cold-pressed, which means the paper has what artists call tooth.
Right.
It's not pressed between hot rollers to be perfectly smooth like printer paper. Mm-hmm. It retains a microscopic texture of tiny peaks and valleys from the manufacturing process.
And you take that specific topography, the texture paper, and you pair it with those Daniel Smith pigments. These specific paints are famous in the watercolor community for their granulating properties.
Granulation.
The pigment particles in these paints are physically heavier and larger than standard pigments.
I love this concept. Let me see if I can explain this physical process with an analogy.
Go for it.
Think about a vinyl record. A pristine digital audio file is completely smooth, right? There's no friction, no physical resistance.
Pure data.
Exactly. But a vinyl record has those physical microscopic grooves cut into the wax. And when the heavy needle drags through those grooves, you get that warm, physical crackling sound that instantly makes a track feel vintage, atmospheric, and alive.
That analogy holds up perfectly when you look at the mechanics of granulation. What's fascinating here is that in watercolor, the heavy, mineral-based pigment particles in the paint act exactly like that needle. When you lay down a wash of water on the paper, instead of drying in a smooth, flat, uniform layer, these specific granulating pigments fall out of suspension. They are heavy, so gravity just pulls them down into the microscopic valleys of the paper's tooth as the water slowly evaporates.
Leaving the peaks of the paper slightly exposed while the valleys are dark and saturated with pigment. So you end up with this mottled, textured, almost sandy finish on the paper.
And this physical settling creates a tactile, humid atmosphere that directly mimics the rainy, heavy climate of the Andean tropics.
Oh, that's brilliant.
Think about standing in a thick, warm fog. The air feels heavy, almost granular against your skin. The artist is utilizing the actual physics of the medium as a storytelling tool.
The way the water evaporates and heavy minerals interact with textured cotton.
Exactly. So what some structural critics might dismiss as a wall of fog or a muddy technical error is actually a brilliant manipulation of chemistry to represent a humid evening.
Because if he had used a perfectly smooth paper and a smooth synthetic paint to create a hard, crisp edge on the buildings, it would completely ruin the honest representation of that specific atmospheric tropic.
It would feel wrong.
Yeah, the weather itself doesn't have hard edges, so the physical paint on the paper shouldn't either.
The medium literally becomes the message. The unpredictable physical reality of the evaporating water and settling pigment becomes the emotional reality of the unpredictable fading memory.
That's a great way to put it.
The loss of control in the drying process mirrors the loss of control we have over our own fading past.
Art is entirely subjective, though, and not everyone agrees that this wall of fog is a complete success.
True.
This leads us right into the big technical debate in our sources, the battle between fluidity and structure. What makes this source material so compelling is that Jairo Duke himself offers a really honest, almost brutal self-critique of his own piece.
It is incredibly rare to have an artist dissect their own work with such technical detachment. Duke notes in his self-critique that the painting suffers from a lack of what is called tonal hierarchy.
Let's make sure we unpack tonal hierarchy, because it's a huge concept in how our brains process visual information.
Definitely.
Basically, it's the arrangement of lights and darks that tells our human optical system how deep a space is. But Duke admits that in Sevilla, the midtones, you know, the objects in the middle distance and the background tones, are just too similar in their darkness.
Which causes the entire image to flatten out optically. Instead of looking like a three-dimensional street you could physically walk down, it starts to look like a flat theater backdrop.
Oh, I can see that.
And this has to do with how our eyes evolve to perceive distance through the atmosphere.
Right, atmospheric perspective. In the real world, atmospheric perspective dictates that things further away look flatter, grayer, and far less detailed because you're literally looking through a lot of air, humidity, and dust particles.
Yep, the air gets in the way.
Those particles scatter the light waves. But our sources point out a specific choice Duke made that violates this biological rule.
Right.
He painted objects in the foreground, like the synthetic figures of the young people, and this iconic Willy's Jeep parked right on the street with the same flat, unresolved tones as the distant background.
By using the same flat tones for the Jeep in the foreground and the architecture in the background, he's visually telling the viewer's brain that the Jeep is just as far away as the horizon line.
It totally collapses the space.
It collapses the space entirely, yeah. The brain is looking for a physical anchor and just can't find one.
And this is exactly where the critics argue for a technique called secco sobre secco, or dry brush. They say this technique would fix the collapsed space.
Right. Dry brushing relies on the friction of the paper we discussed earlier. You take a brush with almost all the water squeezed out of it, load it with dark, thick paint, and drag it really quickly across the dry paper.
So it only hits the top of those bumps.
Because there's no water to carry the pigment down into the valleys, the paint only catches on the very highest peaks of the paper's tooth. It creates a highly crisp, broken, textured mark with hard edges.
The structural argument in our sources says that Duke just needed two or three strategic dry brush strokes.
That's it. Just a few.
Maybe on the heavy rubber tires of the Jeep or on the sharp edge of the curb right in front of the viewer. Just a tiny bit of sharp, dark, mathematical contrast.
Yeah.
They argue this would provide scale and proximity. It would take that beautiful, humid, foggy background and push it backward, giving the viewer's brain a solid, sharp ground to stand on while they look into the depth of the memory.
To give the fog a skeleton, basically, to provide structural integrity to the emotion.
There's a musical analogy in the sources that I think beautifully clarifies why this matters.
Oh, I love this analogy.
Yeah, so if you look at the sweeping, translucent sky in this painting, Duke uses these audacious, gorgeous, chromatic transitions of deep, cool blues, violets, and warm oranges. That sky is like a lush, soaring string section in a symphony orchestra.
It's expansive and deeply emotional.
But every piece of music, no matter how lush the strings are, needs a drum beat. It needs sharp percussion to keep time, to ground the listener, and to give the melody structure. In a painting, those sharp, high-contrast edges and dark, dry-brush shadows are that drum beat.
The structure provides a necessary rhythm for the eye to follow. Without those sharp anchors, the viewer can experience visual fatigue. They're constantly searching for something solid to hold on to in the mist.
So the core of the debate really is, does this beautiful fog need a skeleton? Does the string section require a snare drum to work?
The structural critique is mathematically sound, sure. But there is a profound psychological counterargument to consider here.
Okay.
If we connect this back to what we discussed earlier about the biological nature of memory, imposing a mathematical skeleton or prioritizing physical realism actually breaks the psychological spill of the artwork.
Walk me through that. Like, how does adding a crisp, realistic shadow break the spell?
Well, if you put sharp, hyper-realistic dry brush details in the foreground, like perfectly rendering the tread on the Jeep's tires, you are suddenly reminding the viewer of the physical reality of the object in front of them.
Right.
You are waking them up from the dream state of nostalgia and reminding their brain, hey, you are looking at dark pigments scratched onto flat paper.
Oh, wow. I never thought about it like that.
The lack of structure, the purposeful absence of the drumbeat, is a voluntary subtraction by the artist. He is intentionally starving the viewer's eye of crisp details to simulate a memory in the exact moment just before it fades completely from consciousness.
Adding the dry brush might make it technically correct according to the laws of atmospheric perspective and physics, but it would make it emotionally false.
Exactly.
It would turn a fleeting memory into a static photograph.
The counterargument suggests that the artist is willingly trading physical space for psychological space. The flatness isn't a mistake, it's the entire point.
That concept, trading physical space for psychological space, brings us to the final section of our sources, which takes this technical debate about dry brushing and tonal hierarchy and looks at the profound emotional payoff of these intentional flaws.
Yeah.
Let's look at the background tower in the painting.
The artist mentions that the background tower acts as a symbolic and visual anchor for the whole composition, even though it completely lacks structural drawing.
He doesn't anchor it by drawing sharp architectural lines or using high contrast.
Mm.
He anchors it using color temperature.
Right.
There is this powerful, vibrating contrast between the deep, receding, cool blue of the night sky and the warm, glowing orange of the tower. He forces your eye to look at the tower not with a drafted line, but with a clash of optical temperatures.
And this specific technical choice leads us to what is perhaps the most fascinating psychological insight from our sources, the concept of transgenerational memory.
Yes.
This is where the lack of detail becomes an act of immense generosity by the artist.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Think about what would happen if Gyro Duke had actually listened to the structural critique.
Okay.
Imagine he used hard edges, hyper-detailed the Willy's Jeep with the dry brush technique so you could see the exact year and model, and clearly defined the bell bottoms and 1970s collars on the clothing of the figure standing in the street.
If he had locked those details in with sharp precision, the painting would be entirely closed off to anyone who wasn't there.
Exactly.
It would become a diorama behind museum glass. You know, fascinating to look at perhaps, but emotionally impenetrable.
If you were a 20-year-old listening to this right now, and you look at a hyper-detailed, mathematically perfect painting of a 1970 street scene, your brain instantly categorizes it.
Yep.
You think, oh, that's a historical document. That's my grandpa's era. That has absolutely nothing to do with my life.
But by purposely blurring the historical details, by refusing to give the viewer the sharp edges of the vintage clothing or the precise mechanical lines of the Jeep, Duke isn't being technically lazy.
No.
He is purposefully creating an empty space within the image. He is leaving the narrative slightly unresolved.
He's leaving room for you. By keeping the figures as blurry, warm shapes in the humid night, he's inviting you, the listener, to project your own memories onto his canvas.
That's the beauty of it.
You can look at that blurry street and see your own Friday night hangouts, your own memories of flirting under a street lamp, your own experiences with the heavy summer rain.
It completely transforms Sevilla from a static, rigid historical document into a living, transgenerational space.
Yeah.
The poetic loss of sharp edges ensures that nostalgia isn't treated like an exclusive club just for people who happen to be born in 1950.
I love that.
The emotion of longing, of remembering a rainy evening with friends, that belongs to human biology, not to a specific decade.
Hmm.
The fluid, unstructured watercolor makes that universal connection possible because it doesn't dictate exactly what you are seeing.
We've covered a tremendous amount of ground today, looking at how an artist builds a world out of water and pigment.
We really have.
We've looked at the delicate, razor-thin frontier between the physical representation of a city, which relies on the strict mathematical rules of perspective, the optical need for dry brush accents, and tonal hierarchy, and the immaterial evocation of a city, built out of fluid washes, color temperatures, and granular fog settling into the tooth of cold-pressed paper.
It highlights the eternal tension in all visual art, really. I mean, do you use your technical skills to paint what your optic nerve sees, or do you use those same skills to paint what your heart remembers?
Right.
Because they require entirely different approaches to the canvas.
I want to ask you, the listener, to reflect on this the next time you think about the past. We all carry two distinct versions of our hometowns inside us.
Mm-hmm.
One version is made of concrete, property lines, geographical coordinates, and math. The other version is painted entirely with scattered light, heavy rain, and raw feeling.
Yeah.
When you close your eyes and picture that street you grew up on, which version actually feels more true to you?
It challenges how we value the information our physical senses give us in the present moment versus the information our emotions preserve and protect over decades. Sometimes the blurriness is just the most accurate part of the story.
And that leaves us with one final thought to mull over, extending beyond the debate in our sources.
Okay.
We've talked extensively about how Duke's physical distance in California, the reality of his creative exile, dictated the atmospheric blurriness of his memory.
Right, the displacement.
But consider this counterfactual. If Jairo Duque had painted this exact same street on Calle Real while actually living in Colombia in the 1970s, setting up his easel right on the pavement rather than looking back from a studio in California decades later, would the strict visual rules of architectural perspective have overpowered the emotional fluidity of the watercolor?
Oh, that's an interesting question.
Would the physical proximity have forced him to paint the hard concrete instead of the feeling of the rain?
It makes you wonder.
How much of what we call an artist's distinct style is actually just the physical painted shape of their own longing?